Welcome to a new episode of Plants and the Microcosm. In this podcast, we dive into current research on the interaction of plants with microorganisms. My name is Dagmar Hahn, and together with scientists from the Transregional Research Network TRR356 Plant Microbe, I regularly take a literal look deep below the surface and inside plant tissues. Although we can't see them, numerous microorganisms can be found in and around plants and have a major influence on plant growth, plant health, and therefore also our nutrition. Today's guests are Professor Dr. Ralf Hückelhofen and Professor Dr. Aurélien Tellier, both working at the School of Life Sciences at the Technical University of Munich. Good morning, Ralf, and good morning, Aurélien. I'm super happy to have you here today and to talk to you about your research within the TRR.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be here.
So, Aurélien, do you have a favorite plant in the garden or in the lab?
Yeah, I like tomatoes, obviously. So I work with tomatoes, and I like tomatoes.
And you grow them also?
Or? Yeah, a little bit, not too many. A few on the terrace.
Nice. So if you could be a microbe for a day, which one would you like to be?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I like that. I was thinking, oh, what would I like to do? So I like a forest and nature. So I thought I would be a mycorrhizal fungus living in a forest. And because I also like more cooperation than competition. So I think it's a maybe nice lifestyle.
So you basically are connected to everyone and everything.
Exactly. And you connect the trees and the other microorganisms and all the weeds and so on.
Well, that's nice. I can relate to that. So do you remember the moment when you knew I want to be a scientist?
No, but I don't know. I think it's more a general process. I guess I'd always like history and mathematics and biology. So at some point I try to find something which is a mix of probably the three, right? And that's why I do population genetics, I'm guessing.
Ralf, do you have a favorite plant?
Perhaps barberry. Okay. It's beautiful. It's beautiful leaf colors around the year. Nice reddish fruits. And it's an intermediate host for a pathogen.
This brings me to the microbe. If you could be a microbe, which one would you like to be for a day?
I would be the nasty one. So actually, Blumeria. It is a pathogen that has managed to infect plants with just a low number of genes. I think this is a challenge. I somehow like it.
Sounds good. So do you remember the moment when you knew I want to be a scientist?
So not really in the detail, but when during the studies, I liked the internships, but it was only in the diploma thesis when I had the feeling I can do something new, and that somehow triggered something in me.
Thanks a lot for your insights, Ralf. Before we dive deeper into your research, I'd like to circle back to you, Aurélien. You are a specialist in population genetics and plant evolution. For listeners who may be not familiar with the field, could you briefly explain what population genetics actually is?
Yeah, so population genetics is maybe a subfield of evolutionary biology. And so I think while evolution focuses on the evolution of traits and characters, so for example, like new organs or how different plants develop between angiosperms and trees and so on. I think the population genetics focuses on shorter time scale on the order of maybe 10 to thousands of generations. And we try to understand at the genetic level how this novelty come to arise and how they are selected or not by natural selection. So how basically on the short time scale plant adapt to their environment, for example, or microbe to the plants.
So if we take a plant now, let's take the tomato. That's basically why one variety grows better in this environment and the other in that other environment is what you can study and find out with your population genetics?
Yes. So what we would like to see is track over time changes of the frequency, so the proportion of this trait in a population. So if you have few individuals at the beginning who are more adapted maybe to drought conditions, let's say for plants, then over time, if there is positive selection for this trait, that means more and more plants will have this trait because they will reproduce better than the others. And that's what we track over time with our population genetics models. And the ultimate aim is that we want to analyze genome data to see the signatures in the genome, to find out the genes which are involved in these changes over time.
Okay, nice. Your background is really interdisciplinary. So you studied or you have a background in agronomy, plant biology, genetics and statistics. How did you bring these different fields together and how has this shaped your approach to population genetics and plant evolution?
So I must disclaim that population genetics is a very theoretical field. Yes. And so we start from mathematics. And I usually use the analogy that this is really like physics or like quantum physics. So we build models, we try to test these models with real data. And if we see the model doesn't fit, then we go back to the model and then change it, right? And then we do experiment to test again. And so I think why we do that is because the principles apply to probably any species on the planet, whether we talk about bacteria, fungi, plant, or animals. Mm-hmm. Population genetics has been extremely successful also in human genetics mm-hmm. in the recent years. Because all these mechanisms are so universal, actually, to describe them, we need mathematics, right? Mm-hmm. Because mathematics is the universal language of science. And that's why then I was always interested to not only look at phenomena, but describe them with the mathematics and mm-hmm. then use statistics to test mm-hmm. whether the mathematical model is true. That said, though, as I'm an agronomist, I mean, small part nowadays, but I still would like also to use this knowledge to improve, for example, agriculture and sustainability in agriculture. Mm-hmm. So that's why I try to do the bridge also with more applied mm-hmm. consequences of understanding this evolution.
You talked about that these concepts are very universal. Are you collaborating then also with people, or are you in exchange with people from all these different fields, or...?
Yes, so I collaborate with colleagues who work on human genetics. Mm-hmm. I also myself work, we started a project now on marine snails. Oh. So we sequence marine snails from the Mediterranean and try to understand how they adapt to change of climate change, water temperature over thousands of years where the water has changed a lot in the Mediterranean. So we can apply basically the models to many different mm-hmm. Species. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. I think I work mainly on plants by interest, but you can also apply to other. Mm.
You probably can learn also then from the other experiences in the other fields.
Of course, and every species is different, right? Mm. So you have different life cycle, different type of reproduction. For example, sexual reproduction we'll talk about later. So all this makes differences between species. So you need always to adjust, of course, the models and the questions.
So what motivated you to investigate coevolution between plants and pathogens? How did you get to that field?
So I studied agronomy, as you said, and so I think in agronomy, mainly I got interested in two parasites or pathogens of crops.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got into coevolution, via the way of, can we understand coevolution enough between the plant and the pathogen so that we can make agriculture more sustainable? That always has been a question in the background. Maybe I should define what coevolution is, maybe. So I think what I mean is here the kind of reciprocal change that happens in the genome of the plant and the pathogen over time due to their interaction. That means when the plants get infected, they produce less seeds, right? Because their fitness will decrease, so to say. And that means that then the plants which are more resistant should have an advantage over plants which are less resistant. In the same time, the pathogen will then evolve to counteract this resistance and evolve new mutations, which will then allow it to infect better the plants. And over time, you have always this kind of red queen dynamics that maybe we come back later, which is important to understand the coevolution between the host and the parasite.
It's kind of an arms race, right?
Yeah, so I try to refrain to use arms race for reason of military purposes and so on, which I'm not sure I'm very comfortable with. So in evolution, we use the Red Queen metaphor from Alice Through the Looking Glass. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that the queen always runs in the same place and the environment doesn't change, right? So they stay in the same place and they run very fast. And the idea is here that host and parasite, they don't run somewhere. They just run in the same place against each other just to avoid to get extinct, right? Mm-hmm. If the parasite is not able to infect, it will just die out. And so that's the idea of this race that leads nowhere, where the arms race sometimes is a little bit more in the direction that there will be an improvement, which we don't know necessarily a priori. Mm.
So what kind of pathogens are you interested in or working with at the moment?
So in our project, we work on Blumeria. Mm-hmm. I guess Ralf will give a bit more insights about this pathogen on barley. We have also another project where we work on Fusarium and Ramularia also of barley. Mm-hmm. So we do a full study of different barley pathogens. Mm-hmm. And I work also on Phytophthora and different other pathogens of tomato.
Mm-hmm. Quite some devastating pathogens that you work with.
Yes, well, we don't have many in the lab, right? So no worries.
Okay. So in your empirical research, you also work with wild tomato species from South America. You already mentioned that. What makes these plants such valuable models for studying genome evolution? And what insights can you provide about evolutionary terms from these studies?
Yeah, so I started to work during my postdoc on the wild tomato, and since then I continue. So I think it's a very nice system because that's the most southern tomato species in South America. So they are in northern Chile and southern Peru. And I think they're found around the Atacama Desert. And so that means that they are adapted to very arid, very dry habitats. They also are found between sea level up to above 3,000 meters of altitude. So they are adapted to a really wide range of abiotic conditions, right? So temperature, amount of rainfall, UV lights, and so on. And that's what we try to understand, this adaptation to local conditions. I think they are also interesting, of course, because they are related to the cultivated tomato. And so the idea is that if we, for example, find out maybe genes or pathways which are involved in arid adaptation, we could transfer that to tomato to make them more resistant, for example, to drought.
And now one other question that you already teased is, what do pathogens have to do with sexual reproduction?
Yeah, so the idea, if you follow this metaphor of the red queen, right, that you run against each other to stay in the same place, the pathogen have an inherent advantage because usually they reproduce faster. Right? Yeah. If we think about bacteria, they have generation time of a few hours up to even less, right? The fungi also can reproduce very fast, have maybe life cycle of a couple of days of reproduction. So the host cannot beat that, right? If you're a plant and you live for long enough, you cannot reproduce as fast and change as fast your genetics. And so one of the way which is believed that hosts do that is by doing sexual reproduction. So by doing sexual reproduction, you remix the genotypes, so the mutations which are present in the population, and you create always new combination of genotypes, which some of them by luck might be adapted to the pathogen which will come in the future. And so that's the idea why sexual reproduction, one of the main hypotheses why sex has evolved in life history is because of all the strong interaction between all life forms on the planet, not only host parasite, but also competitions between species for resources.
I see. If you could give one piece of advice to someone interested in combining evolution, genomics and plant biology, what would it be?
I'm not sure I have really a good advice, but I would say that I think we live in exciting times now because we have genomics, which I think allows us to test really amazingly in detail, test in amazing details, the prediction of evolutionary theory. However, I think the question is, we still probably need new theory to be developed in the future. And so I would advise probably people to try to keep an eye open on not only put all their dice on AI to use data, but that we need to maybe think a bit on our own also how to interpret this AI models, which will be developed and are very useful, but also to guide them via the use of theoretical work. And I think that's the way evolution always has progress, is also by new theoretical work, which suggests new hypotheses, and sometimes later on people get the data to test it.
Okay. How much does AI play a role in your work?
And so I think AI is very useful because it allows now to, for example, test protein-protein interaction, do predictions at an amazing level of refinement at the molecular level. I think also for genome annotation, for genome alignment. Yeah. So I think when we handle all this genomic data, and for example, RNA-seq data, transcriptome data in addition, that gives us a lot of possibilities now to put this data together and understand better how the genome evolves. And so I think evolution will be revolutionized by AI. At the moment, I would still say that most of the AI model follow the hypothesis which were built from the theory. So I think we need to see whether they can get more independent from that and gain new insights via AI analysis of this big data set.
Okay, Ralf, now let's come to you. So you studied biology in Aachen and later completed your PhD and habilitation at the University of Gießen. What were the key moments that inspired you to specialize in plant pathology?
Yeah, actually, I was more trained as an ecologist, plant physiologist, microbiologist. But we had a lot of teachers in Aachen, like Scheinflug, Schaffrath, Tibozzi, and they were talking a lot about plant pathology and the damage the pathogens do to the plants. And that somehow sparked my interest already, and that also later motivated me to actually apply for a PhD with Kalle Kogel then, and mm-hmm. move with him to Gießen then.
And ever since you worked with plant pathogens, right?
Yeah, right.
And the really bad ones as well?
Yeah, of course. So it depends on what you call a bad pathogen. So all of them make damage to the plant and reduce crop yield or quality. But I have also some of the nasty ones in the lab, so the so-called necrotrophic pathogens that really try to kill the plant.
Are you more interested in the host or in the microbe? What's your...
Yeah, most of my work is actually on the host side, so I'm more a plant person. Mm-hmm. But in the recent years, I'm kind of changing to the other side of the road and do more and more on the pathogen side too.
Was this inspired by Aurélien, that you moved to the pathogen side?
Yes and no. So it's always good if you have collaboration partners. Yeah. It can help you to understand actually in depth the evolution of a pathogen, but also the new genomic tools and the sequencing possibilities in general. That was, of course, a reason. So 10 years ago, it was much more difficult to do something reasonable on the pathogen side. Mm.
So you said earlier some of them are necrotrophs. So pathogens can be either biotrophs, hemobiotrophs, or necrotrophs. Could you explain to us what that means?
Yeah, so I did already say the necrotrophs kill the plant. Mm. So they when they colonize the plant, they kill the plant cells and then they digest the dead material. So this is a very simple way of pathogenesis. But there are much more gentle forms of pathogenesis where the plant cells are invaded usually by so-called biotrophic pathogens that establish feeding structures in living plant cells and then interact for a very long time. It can be weeks with living plant cells, just taking the nutrients out of the cells to make their living.
And the ones that you work with in the TRR are biotrophic fungi?
Yeah, so we, as Aurélien mentioned, we are working with Blumeria fungi. That's a genus that infects grasses, the true powdery mildew fungus of grasses, and it's a biotrophic pathogen. It forms so-called haustoria, so this infection structures in living plant cells.
So your work digs into how plants defend themselves, so the plant immunity in a way, and especially around transport and signaling. Maybe you can break it down for us and our listeners what this exactly means.
So the plant, if it wants to defend against the invading fungus, it has to focus its defense on the point where the pathogen breaks into the cell, through the plant cell wall. And this concentration of the defense needs a reorientation of plant endogenous structures to the point of attack to focus all the defense material the plant has on this point to concentrate it there so that the defense can be right in time and place and can be effective. And that is a process that is very crucial for the efficacy of the defense. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the pathogen may also profit from something like that, because to invade a plant cell, it also needs help from the plant cell, and that will also need some of this focusing of the transport machinery of the plant to the pathogen infection site.
So maybe we can walk it through together. So the plant has a strong cell wall, right? And the fungus needs to get through that cell wall inside the plant cell in order to build this feeding structure.
Right.
So when you look at the fungus, how does it start to get through that cell wall? And what's the first thing that happens when it tries to get through?
Mm-hmm. So actually the fungus has usually two different means to go through the cell wall. One is enzymes. So it's hydrolytic enzymes that simply digest the cuticle of or the plant cell wall, the pectin, the cellulose in the plant cell. But it also has mechanical force. So it builds turgor pressure. And by this turgor pressure, it pushes its own structures through the plant cell wall. And on the plant cell, this is recognized. So on the one hand, most likely the mechanical pressure is recognized. And on the other hand, the molecules that are derived from the enzymatic activity of the pathogen, so the breakdown products of the plant cell wall, are recognized. Mm. And pathogen molecules are recognized. And all this may happen in a local environment where the pathogen tries to invade.
I can imagine that it's important that these molecules are secreted by the pathogen very locally, because what the pathogen doesn't want is to kill the cell, right? Otherwise, it couldn't live as a biotroph. So it's probably very punctual on the cell wall.
Yeah, so the the pathogen has a so-called oppressorium. It's mm-hmm. a special cell that glues to the surface of mm-hmm. the plant. And there, it's a downside, plant-oriented side of this mm-hmm. structure. It secretes very locally these enzymes mm-hmm. and also pushes a structure very locally mm-hmm. into the plant cell. Mm-hmm.
How would pathogens then try to trick the plants and evade this or suppress the plant immune response to succeed in the infection?
Yeah, so the necrotrophs do it simply with toxins, and the biotrophs have what we call effector molecules. Mm-hmm. Most of them are proteins, and we do not exactly know how, but they manage to bring the proteins into the cytosol of the mm-hmm. plant, so into the inner space of the plant cell. And there they bind to plant proteins to either block their function. For instance, if they are immune components of the plant, mm-hmm. they will be simply blocked so that they cannot work in immunity anymore. Or to in a process that is perhaps comparable to a hostile takeover. Mm-hmm. So they really reprogram the plant cell functions to steer the processes into a direction that is good for the pathogen and not good for the plant mm-hmm. anymore.
How many such effectors does a pathogen like Blumeria need to succeed?
Yeah, this is a very good question, which is not yet answered in literature. But if you look into the genome of mm-hmm. Blumeria, it has 7,000 to 8,000 genes, and 800 to 1,000 of them are so-called effector genes. Mm. So the genetic repertoire is huge. Mm. If you imagine it has 1,000 different tools just to trick the plant, that's enormous. But we do not really understand whether it really needs all thousands of these, or maybe it's just a backup, let's say, to have different possibilities that it needs to infect the plant. Yeah.
But for sure, a quite impressive inventory that it has.
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. And we only understand a very little part of this, actually. Yeah.
So your research spans molecules, cells, and ecosystems. Is that correct?
Let's say field, so agro-ecosystems. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Agro-ecosystems, okay.
Yeah.
How do you balance focusing on the fine details with keeping the bigger picture in mind?
Yeah, so for me, it always belonged somehow together. Mm-hmm. So for me, always a part of the motivation to work in plant pathology was also agriculture and protecting plants with perhaps genetic means or other means to make sustainable plant protection possible. So from the motivation side, it's not a problem. Sometimes it's difficult to bring that all together in one laboratory. Mm-hmm. But this you can break up in single pieces. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I have small teams that are then either working on the molecular level, on the cellular level, on the whole plant level, or even in the field. It's teamwork of sub-teams in my laboratory that focus on these different aspects.
So how big is your team then?
Yeah, that's also depending on how you define a team. Yeah. Because my chair is 20 people, 25 people.
Yeah.
But we have sub-teams, and some of them are really independent of me.
Speaking of the lab, every lab has its own rhythm. How does a typical day in yours look like? And is there such a thing as a typical day?
I don't think so, actually. So we don't have typical routine days because we are doing so many different things that usually it happens very rarely that 1 week looks like the next week or one day looks similar to the next day. So we try to combine those different methods from molecular biology to field studies, and that actually already says that there is usually not much routine work in our laboratory happening.
Actually, to me, it sounds like it's a fantastic learning opportunity to be in your lab, because you can get insights into such different aspects of plant pathogen interactions.
It's also part of the motivation again, because if you try to spread your work from all these scales, it's very good for teaching, actually. Mm-hmm. So I'm also a teacher, so my students try to bring that different levels to the students so that they get the whole picture. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Let's move to the TRR, to the reason why we are together. So our TRR356 Collaborative Research Center is where you also have a project in. And your project here focuses on transposable elements in the barley powdery mildew fungus Blumeria hordei. Now, what are transposable elements, Aurelien?
Yeah, so transposable elements, if we say it very quickly, are parasite of the genome, right? So the genome has its own parasite, and these transposable elements, they are genes or pieces of the DNA which can move in a genome. So sometimes they just copy themselves and paste themselves somewhere else, and some other elements, they can even duplicate themselves and invade the genome. Right? And so I was thinking actually before of a metaphor maybe to explain why Blumeria has so many transposable elements. So I think we always say that it's a bargain with the devil. Mm-hmm. So it's a very Faustian character, right? Like in Goethe, where on one hand, you have a huge advantage to have this transposable element because they can jump very fast and create new genes. I think Ralph will give more detail about what we expect there. But on the long run, they also can mess up completely your genome, right? So the genome can get disorganized. You can get many genes which get non-functional, and then you lose at the end the ability to reproduce and infect. And so there is a bit of a trade-off between the short-term advantage of having this transposable element and the long term, where most of the species we know who have so many transposable elements, it seems the lineage over evolutionary time do not make it very long and get extinct.
Mm. So one of the questions your project addresses is whether diversity is observed and selection occurs at transposable elements and TE-derived effector genes. Could you explain what this means in practice and why it's important for understanding pathogen evolution?
I may start with the diversity part, actually. So the genome of Blumeria is composed by 3/4 of transposable elements.
3/4?
Yeah, so 75%. So this is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that there is certain types of transposable elements that have multiplied into the genome to an extent that is really enormous. Not all of them are active anymore, but several of them are active. And we also see when we sequence the genome now that this is not identical copies. So it's not always the same. So during jumping around, maybe the sequence has changed, or if they stop jumping, still mutations may happen on them and so on and so forth. And we see now that we have transcripts from those transposable elements in high diversity, and even peptides deriving from the transposable elements that are not just for multiplying the transposons, as you would expect, but most likely have taken up other functions in the evolution. And we are just beginning to understand whether there is selection on this or not.
And these other functions, could these also include effector functions, as we discussed earlier?
Yeah, actually, this was one of our main hypotheses in the project. We had found in the past one example of such a transposable element-derived effector candidate.
Yeah.
That was actually a peptide encoded on a transposable element that could make it into the plant and bind to a plant protein and manipulate the function for virulence of the pathogen. And we wanted to understand whether this is a singular event or whether maybe the amount of transposable elements in Blumeria allows the fungus to have more such things as an evolutionary playground to develop new effectors. Yeah.
So can you trace back since when Blumeria has this impressive repertoire on TEs? Or is this completely unknown when the expansion or whatever the explosion of TE elements in Blumeria occurred?
I cannot give you numbers, but what is visible in the genome of Blumeria, and this is quite typical for the powdery mildew fungi, they lost one of the defense mechanisms that usually is existing in fungi to defend the genome against this genomic parasites, the transposable elements.
Mm-hmm.
This is so-called repeat-induced point mutation machinery. Mm. And this is not existing in Blumeria anymore. Mm. So at a certain point, it has kicked that overboard, apparently to allow the multiplication of the transposable elements because it may have been of use for the pathogen. Yeah, but when that actually exactly happened, I don't know.
But it seems like Blumeria is quite successful with having all these TEs, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah, but it's not generally that all pathogens have it.
Mm.
We see it quite often in pathogens that we have an expansion of TEs, in also in some obligate biotrophs like Blumeria and in some rust fungi and so on and so forth. But there are also super successful pathogens who have very few transposable elements.
So when the TE jumps, can it happen that it takes a bit of the host genome with it to another place in the genome? Or is it always exclusively the TE that jumps and the mutations are only created by the insertion of the TE at a different place?
Actually, a lot of different mechanisms are existing. Mm. How TEs can contribute to the duplication of genes. So actually, template switching is one of them. So when they copy and paste, they sometimes switch the template and take other transcripts with them to make longer transcripts that are then integrated. This is one of the mechanisms. Yeah. but also ectopic recombination events. So when in the recombination, not only classical crossing over happens, but somehow an unequal crossing over events happen, these transposons can facilitate that because there are so many copies in the genome and they are close to identical, that so that ectopic recombination is supported by this.
Olivier, I think you wanted to add something.
I think one should be careful to not, in evolution, always interpret from what we see nowadays what has happened in the past, right? And so what is the reason why you have so many transposable elements, I think in Blumeria, but also many pathogens, is still unclear. And I would argue that, for example, it's also very likely you have random event that can happen. And so maybe the machinery to the RIP machinery Ralph mentioned was maybe removed by mutation or by unluck it happened. And then that allowed the transposable element to invade the genome. And then I think at that moment you have the choice that either the lineage will just die out because there are too many transposable elements and it's not sustainable, or there is still a way that the genome will cope with this transposable element one way or another. Why is Blumeria successful? That's a question I would also argue in evolution of point of view. It is successful because also humans are in agriculture having a large monoculture for barley, which means that once the pathogen can invade some fields, especially if you take Bavaria or Germany as regions, you have often the same lines which are cultivated over large landscapes, which means that for the pathogen, once you have the good mutation which allow you to overcome a resistant gene in the barley lines, you can infect a lot of potential host. If you think in nature, this is totally not the case because the Blumeria in the wild grasses are never able to find the same lines of grass and the same genes all the time because they will be in an area where you have many different grasses which are very diverse genetically. So actually, we suspect that transposable elements are also very useful in the agricultural context for the pathogen because, in fact, once you have the right mutation, you can explode your population size and invade a lot of fields, while in the wild, it's very likely that this is very detrimental because, in fact, you have always a lot of diversity of the host, so it's not so easy to always have the right mutation to infect.
So Blumeria is an obligate biotroph. Could it be that it can also tolerate all these TEs? Because a lot of metabolic processes or, you know, pathways that the pathogen needs to get all the nutrients and survive and so on are actually provided by the plant, and it's not necessary that the pathogen has to do all these jobs?
It's an interesting thought, and it may be perhaps. But as Oya said, it's always difficult to, from nowadays situation, explain what happened in the past. But indeed, Blumeria has less number of regular genes than other fungal pathogens. Most likely because a good part of the functions is provided by the plant. So it's always in contact with the plant. It cannot live apart from the plant. And perhaps this jumping around in the genome of transposable elements and make nonsense was more easy to tolerate for the pathogen because it is supported by the plant. But this is speculation, I would say.
And then one more question along these lines is, would it be a future project idea, or is somebody doing this already, to look at Blumeria in the wild versus Blumeria in the field, to test your hypothesis, Aurélien, whether this is also maybe a human-driven selection?
No, definitely. I think that's exactly a great project to follow up. I think we know only one other Blumeria, which is pathogen of wheat, where we have a lot of sequence, and that has also a lot of transposable elements, so that would follow the same line of thought. I think the main problem, I think, is to find this Blumeria in the wild, right? To harvest them on wild grasses and to do extensive survey to find them where they are and which time of the year and so on. There is also a lot of unknown, for example, about the sexual reproduction of those pathogens, where sometimes they do at which time of the year. And that's also very important to understand the dynamic of adaptation.
Okay.
And that's there is a lot of difference between the wild pathogen and the pathogen from crops.
One of the questions your project addresses is whether diversity is observed and selection occurs at transposable elements and TE-derived effector genes. Yeah, this is what we established. How do you go about detecting selection on TEs and TE-derived possible effector genes? And are there particular genomic or computational methods that make this possible, or that you even had to develop in order to investigate this?
The idea from sequencing the genomes is that we can compare many strains right, of Blumeria. So when we compare the strains, you have different type of polymorphism. So mutations which are not present in all strains. This is the polymorphic side. So we can have either point mutations or what are called SNPs, right? So single mutations which are, for example, in effectors between the strains. Then you can have also, for example, more insertion or deletion, so piece of genes which are completely inserted or deleted. And you can have polymorphism for transposable element, which are present or absent in different parts of the genome, sometimes in the gene, sometimes around the genes. And when the transposable element are in a gene, for example, that can have large consequences on the gene function. When they are around the gene, they also influence their transcription, right, and the gene expression. And so how do we now look at the selection? What we would like to do is when we sequence all these genomes, we can use population genetics methods which predict if a mutation, either due to T or not, is under selection. That means that we will have a particular signature in the polymorphism data that we observe in the sequences. So what that means is that there are particular pattern of mutations that we can observe, and we can find them with statistical methods. And based on this method, we can estimate when selection happened, how strong it was. So partially, this method exists for SNPs. They exist for SNPs. We have used them on our wild tomatoes that we discussed earlier. For the transposable element, this method do not exist. And that's what we are also in the same time developing. So we're developing method to align this transposable element to make sure that they are homologous and that's the same transposable element, right, which is in a given place in a genome. And based on their frequency in our sample, then we built a test to know whether there was selection for this transposable element insertion or not.
Can I just ask here, so can you say where the selective force then came from? Or is that, because I imagine that you compare different Blumeria strains grown at different times, grown in different environments. So where is the selection actually coming from?
So there, maybe there are different parts of the questions, I think. So regarding the sampling, in our case, we have a very simple sampling in 1 year in Bavaria and part of northern Germany as well. We have some samples. So there we try to identify, so to say, a Blumeria population of a given year. Right? And we know that Blumeria is dispersing very far. There is a lot of mixing between the different fields, which means any sample in Bavaria belong to a general population. And we see that they reproduce and mix with each other, right, when we look at the genetic data. If you take, of course, different years and maybe different barley lines, or cultivars, which will be in France and in the UK, you start having different isolates, which will look probably more different. And then one has to then treat them a bit separately. But within our population, now we assume that this reflects the state of the population at a given point in time. And then we can, using the genome data, we go back in time. We do history of the population. And that's where we try to understand when was selection at a given part of the genome. The difficulty is that in evolution, nothing is simple because there is a lot of stochastic effect, random effects happening. And that's what exactly we develop methods in the TRR to analyze and disentangle this random effect from the selection effect and to target and to find out exactly where selection has happened. And that's where then Ralf takes over.
Good.
Yeah, so to examples, you ask also for examples of what kind of things might be under selection. So we are, in our population, we are just trying to find those loci. But if you look into the literature, you can have some expectations because some of those effectors are recognized by the plant as foreigner invading pathogen molecules, and that triggers an immune response in the plant. So if you have a certain resistant genotype of the barley in the field, for instance, it may be of advantage for the pathogen to get rid of one of these effectors that is recognized by the plant. And what is observed in literature, that the transposons jump into those genes of those effectors and destroy their function so that the pathogen is not recognized by the plant anymore. So that would be then an advantage for the pathogen, and you would perhaps see a selection on such an event. Yeah. Another famous thing, or simple to understand, is fungicide resistance, because in the field there's a lot of fungicides applied, and sometimes you need to produce more of a protein or gene product as a fungus, and then sometimes you see transposons jumping into the into the promoter of the gene, so the gene steering parts of the gene, so that more protein is, for instance, made under the control of transposons that then amplify the gene expression.
So at this stage of the TRR, you have your inventories of your different Blumeria strains, you have characterized or identified the TEs, you have the sequencing data, you looked at regions of selection, and you also looked at the transcripts and the proteins that are derived from these regions. What will be the next step? What do you do with all this information that you collected and gathered?
Yeah, so actually in an ideal case, the work of Aurélien and my work would somehow converge on certain genes or transposable elements and their derived gene products or peptides. And then we have a locus there is where we know there is selection on it. And we see some exciting new genes or transposable element functions in that. And then we can take those genes from Blumeria and try to understand their function by manipulating the gene function by genetic tools, for instance, by expressing the protein from the pathogen in the plant to see whether it has a function on the plant defense, for instance, or silence the function of the gene in the fungus, so and see then whether the fungus is more or less successful in such a situation. So we can really try to prove that such a genetic element that is under selection has an advantage for the pathogen. Mm.
So you are able to manipulate the Blumeria as well?
Yeah, indirectly. Because an obligate biotroph is super difficult to manipulate. So the trick is actually you express, it's a bit technical now, you express double-stranded RNA in the plant that is taken up by the pathogen and switches off the gene in the pathogen. And we used that methodology in the past and it works. So you can really switch off genes in the pathogen,
So do you already have some interesting candidates?
At the moment, I would say more than we can actually manage to study in the lab. Because the diversity of those transposable element-derived peptides and transcripts is enormous. It goes into the numbers of hundreds and thousands of diverse transcripts and proteins. And that is simply too much to study. So this is why I'm hoping that Aurélien can find those of them where we have selection on it. And then we can focus in particular on those where we know they are really important for the pathogen.
You already work as a team, you collaborate, and I could see from this interview that you complement each other very well. But now you are also part of this TRR356 Collaborative Research Center. How do you profit from these collaborations? How do they benefit your project and your work?
Okay, we have these central projects. So they are, for my part of my work, very beneficial. So for instance, we have a microscopy project. And there we also try to understand the establishment of this haustorium in living plant cells and make three-dimensional reconstructions and the timing of the events. And if we then would overlay this with the timing of the effector expression, for instance, we can perhaps find those effectors that are important for certain steps in the establishment of the parasitic lifestyle. This is, for instance, one point where we can collaborate. Or we have actually a similar project, but on the genetic and transcriptomic level, together with bioinformatics project, where we understand globally which kind of gene expression happens in such invasion event, and whether this is perhaps similar to the invasion of friendly fungi, like mycorrhiza fungi, and what is in common between invasion of a friendly and a nasty fungus, and what is distinct, and to then better understand which processes are actually steering pathogenicity and which is just the establishment of the structure.
So to discriminate what makes a friend and what makes a foe.
Yeah,
maybe I can just extend on that. So it's the same principle also at the genomic level, right? So if we look at the genomic data, the methods we develop, we can apply then also to other plant and pathogen system or plant and symbiont system. The same principle applies that when you have this symbiosis, which is establishing the R genes, which also will change over time between the plant and the symbionts, some symbionts or some plant might be want to cheat the other, and so they mutate to try to evade or to do different interaction, and that we can also track with our method to look at selection, to see if selection has favored, for example, genes which make the pathogen or the symbionts more selfish, and the plant try to retaliate to keep the symbiote at bay.
So is there any publication, book, documentary, podcast that you can recommend to our listeners that they can maybe learn also a little bit more about this topic?
So for the general plant pathology, there is a textbook, which is a standard textbook, yeah. The so-called Agrios, yeah. Plant Pathology. There was a new edition last year. I think it's a generally very nice book to learn about plant pathology in general. And for the TEs, it goes quickly into the details, actually, but there is also nice reviews in genome biology, for instance. Actually, I can't recall the author. Apologies for that, but it's called 10 Things You Have to Know About Transposable Elements. Mm-hmm. It's a very nice review, actually.
Maybe we can put this into the show notes.
I think for people who are interested, I would definitely recommend to read the books of Dawkins, who's a great communicator. I think if you've never read them, it's a classic for evolutionary biology. And I think about evolution of genome and transposable element, there is a book by Michael Lynch, who's let's say the most famous person, I think, with work on genome evolution. And he has a lot about transposable element, mainly in humans, because that's where the data are the most known as well. But I think there is a great example in his books. It's called The Genome Evolution. And I think that's a really nice book.
Thank you. So before I let you go, I would like to ask you 5 questions. You can just give a one word quick answer, and you can just reply one after the other. So is it coffee or tea?
Coffee.
I need both.
Would you prefer field work or lab work?
Lab work.
Oh, I prefer piece of paperwork.
I thought so. Computational or screen time or a day out in nature?
Day out in nature.
Oh, nature, for sure.
Wild plants or cultivated crops?
Crops.
No, wild.
Fungi or bacteria?
Fungi.
Oh, fungi.
Because they're more complex.
Yeah, and more you can eat them.
Okay. Evolutionary theory or applied breeding?
Breeding.
I'll do the theory.
Reading papers or writing papers?
Writing.
I like reading.
Thank you very much for this very interesting interview with you. And it was a pleasure to have you here.
Likewise.
If you would like to know more about the topic of this episode, please take a look at the show notes. In the next episode, I look forward to talking to Mara Richter, a student in the master's program Molecular and Cellular Biology at the Ludwig Maximilians University Munich. We hope you'll tune in to Plants and Their Microcosm for this episode.